So you guys know who this is, Louis Armstrong, Sitting in the Sun, Counting My Money. How many of you have heard that song before? A few of you. I love Louis Armstrong. We, you know, talked about Blink-182 the other week and Rag and Bone Man a couple weeks before that. Why not Louis Armstrong? He's awesome. That song, I think, could be an anthem for our culture. Sitting in the sun, counting my money, happy as I can be. I mean, really, is there anyone here who actually doesn't like money? Like, you see a $20 bill on the side of the road and you pass by on the other side? I mean, really, all of us like money, right? The question is, how much? How much do we like money? How much does money have a hold on us and on our lives? There's an interesting juxtaposition happening, not just in the service, between the offering and that song and then the scriptures. There's an interesting juxtaposition happening in the scriptures themselves between let the little children come to me, the children, the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these, and then the guy coming afterwards. So let's talk a little bit about little children coming to Jesus. Money gives us sort of pride and self-reliance, doesn't it? It gives us the opportunity to say, I got this, God. I don't actually need you. And that is the complete opposite to little children who are dependent, who are going to rely on their parents for everything. And that is the connection, I think, between these two different passages. So Jesus says, then the little children were being brought to him in order that he might lay his hands on them and pray for them. And the disciples spoke sternly to them. But Jesus said, let the little children come to me and do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of heaven belongs. And he laid his hands on them, and then he went on his way. The people are bringing their kids to Jesus so that the local holy man can pray for them and bless them. It's a good thing. But the disciples don't actually like what's happening there for some reason. The disciples seem to have a certain image of the type of people that they want around Jesus and the type of people they don't want around Jesus. We want people who add value to the thing that we are doing with you, Jesus, and kids don't count. Kids are nobodies in the ancient world. They have a certain image of what Jesus should be spending his time doing. We're starting a movement here. We're trying to get this thing going. What are you doing wasting your time with little people? They're not too impressed with this because children, back then especially, are to be seen and not heard. That's just a basic part of their culture, and they certainly were not role models, except to the disciples when Jesus reverses their expectations completely. And he makes children into role models, because children demonstrate trust and dependence in a way that rich people and adults simply don't. Children just believe that you're going to take care of me. There's humility that comes with being a child. Children come without pretense, don't they? Children come without a resume. You know, this rich guy is going to come to Jesus with his resume. And Jesus is telling people ahead of time, no resume required. No resume at all. We don't come to Jesus and give him all of our qualifications and hope that, therefore, based on this stuff, he will like us more and accept us more. And I think that's a truism, but the problem is that we sometimes still approach God that way, don't we? We come to God and I say, God, you know, I've got a biblical name, Benjamin. I'm like, we're one of the good ones, right? And, you know, I was in church the Sunday after I was born. That's got to count for something, right? I've been in Sunday school my whole life. I've been in church my whole life. And then I went on to school. I studied the original languages. I got degrees in this. Like, God, you must really like me for these things, right? Oh, I serve you. Like, I do this, God, you must really, really like me because this is awesome, right? I'm like the rich young ruler. I'm rich, I'm young, and I rule, right? Like, in a sense, we come to God like that, don't we? No, I'm making it funny to make a point, but, you know, this is the way that we sometimes approach God. We come with our resume. I have certain qualifications, I have certain experience, therefore, ... Not so. Maybe you come to God and you say, God, I read my daily bread every single day. And I only watch Disney movies because there's no swearing in those, right? And I've served you downstairs with the kids for so long. Does that provide any leverage? Do we think that it does? We have to come to God with the attitude, here I am, and I got nothing. I have nothing. You know that old song, nothing in my hands I bring? We got to find a way to start cultivating that attitude again, cultivating the attitude of humility, because we have nothing on God, nothing at all, not a thing. So how can we practice that? How can we practice this, nothing in my hands I bring? At a practical level, a number of years ago, I was in seminary, and I was just praying with a couple of guys, and a guy beside me noticed when he prayed, he always prayed with his hands open. I really liked that. I started doing that because it's a way of saying, I'm here to receive whatever it is that you have to give, God, but I'm also here with absolutely nothing. Like, these hands are empty before you. So maybe when you pray, just maybe every time we're here praying in church, I'd encourage you, pray with your hands open. It's a way of bodily reminding ourselves and reminding God, we got nothing. We're here very humbly. I think another way that we can practice humility is by practicing regular confession. Now, I know Protestants tend to react against Catholics because they go to confession. There's absolutely nothing wrong with going to confession. The only reason that Protestants disagree with that is because they disagree with the priest being able to offer absolution, the priest being able to offer forgiveness. But we all need to practice confession. This is a good and healthy thing, and the more that we confess, the more regularly we confess, that will keep us humble. I'd encourage you to make confession part of our regular prayers, and probably part of our regular interactions with one another where we keep shorter accounts. And we say, I'm sorry, I screwed up. You know, confession is part of the prayer that Jesus gives us. Give us today our daily bread, and then forgive us our debts. And at that point, I think it's worth saying to God, and here are the debts I have incurred since the last time we talked. It'll keep us humble. Now, children wouldn't be the disciples' first choice, but this next guy would be their first choice for who they want to join their movement. You'll see starting in verse 16, then someone came to him and said, Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? And he said to him, Why do you ask me about what's good? There's only one who is good. If you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments. This is an interesting moment here. Jesus doesn't tell him right away, come follow me. He says, keep the commandments. He says, well, which ones? Which commandments? And Jesus replies, you know them. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie, etc., etc. Honor your father and mother. Love one another. Well, love your neighbor as yourself. The young man says, I've done that. What still do I lack? This guy's got a glowing resume. I mean, this guy is, to change the metaphor, he's the number one draft pick. That's what this guy is in their cultural understanding. In the disciples' expectations, everyone's going, if we want anyone backing our Jesus movement, it's this guy in particular. He's righteous. He's kept the commandments, and Jesus doesn't contradict him. He doesn't say, actually, buddy, I remember when, or I know. No, Jesus actually seems to agree. And, you know, the Apostle Paul makes the same point in Philippians 3. He says, I kept the law blamelessly. So there are some people that are able to keep all those commandments. Jesus does not contradict him. This is a righteous man in everyone's viewpoint, in everyone's understanding. It's just part of their culture. It's also part of their culture that if you were a good Jewish person who was keeping the commandments, it was expected that you were going to be wealthy. That's part of Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28 lays out blessings and then curses. And if you keep the law, it says in those first, I don't know, 14 verses or so of Deuteronomy 28, God is going to bless you materially in quite a number of ways. And it lists them out. Just go read it. Deuteronomy 28. Read it on your own time. In their cultural expectation, they see a good Jewish boy who's keeping the commandments and he's rich, and they go, God has blessed him. Now, we tend to assume in our culture that rich people got there because they more or less, they're shady, right? Not so in their culture. They have the exact opposite expectations. That goes, in fact, even beyond the Jewish world. So just out in the Gentile world at the time, rich people were understood to be more righteous than poor people because poor people had to lie, cheat, and steal in order to make ends meet. And rich people were assumed that they were therefore more righteous because they didn't have to go do that. This is just the culture in which they live. So these Jewish people here have that in the background. They have Deuteronomy 28 in the background. They go, this is a pretty good candidate for our movement. I really like this. He's first round draft pick. Get those kids out of the way so we can get this guy backing us. And you know what? He's looking for further training too. He's asking the local rabbi, what do I have to do to take the next step to get to the next level? Because he asks the question, I've kept the commandments, what still do I lack? Interesting. Here is one more rich guy once again reminding us that riches are not satisfying. It's not enough. What still do I lack? He says, whether it's Chris Cornell this past week, or whether it's Kurt Cobain 15 years ago, or whether it's Robin Williams last year, how many rich people need to remind us that you reach the top of the game and it's deeply dissatisfying? Here we go again. Here's this guy. So put yourself in the story, because it might be worth our asking Jesus the same question. What still do I lack? I've got money, I've been moral. What still do I lack? Maybe a footnote, by the way. I'm not suggesting that riches are a sign of God's blessing. That's simply one paradigm operating in the Old Testament. The very fact that we have Jesus who dies dirt poor ought to correct that mistake. So you can bring that up again in Q&A if you want. All right, verse 21. Jesus says to him, if you wish to be perfect, if you know you lack something and you wish to be perfect, go and sell your possessions and give the money to the poor and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. When the young man heard this word, he went away grieving, for he had many possessions. Now, if you are new to church or you have just stereotypes or maybe bad experiences, people often gripe. Churches are always talking about money. You know what? Sometimes that's true, because the Bible talks a lot about money. In fact, the Bible tends to talk more often about the things that we are likely to forget about and the things that become liabilities for us than the things that we're not likely to forget about and aren't liabilities for us. I had this brought out to me when I was in seminary, and a professor told us a story. He said, we have a family with three boys at home, so there are four men in this house. There's a lot of testosterone going around. We get really competitive. We end up doing this to each other constantly. We're arguing and bickering back and forth, and my wife has to tell us every single day, talk nicely to each other. Talk nicely to each other. Speak kindly to each other. Treat one another well. She has to tell us that every day. She only had to tell us once not to light the cat on fire. Right? It's not more important to talk nicely to each other. It's simply the thing that they needed to remember and be reminded about more often. Right? So the Bible talks a lot about money because Jesus talks a lot about money. Therefore, churches need to talk a lot about money because it's just a problem and we need to be reminded about it. I can identify with this guy in the story. Right? Rich young ruler. It doesn't actually say he's a ruler. But he's got money in the bank. He's served in church his whole life. He's giving to the poor. He's involved in his missional community. This is a good guy. I can identify with this guy. He's been looking after the poor. That's implicit in the fact that he says, I have loved my neighbor as myself. It's right in the text. Implicit in that is the fact that he's giving to the poor, that he's giving to his local church. That's implied. That's just part of basic Judaism. That they're giving to the temple, that they're making offerings. He's got a really good religious resume. And the problem is that he wants to follow Jesus and love money. And Jesus seems to say, can't do it. It's got you trapped. In one of the commentaries this week I was reading, N.T. Wright points out that if you want to catch a monkey, when in places where monkeys are trouble, what people will do there is they will fix a jar, maybe to the ground, and they will put a piece of fruit in there, and the opening of the jar is just big enough for the monkey to get its hand in. And as soon as it grabs the fruit or grabs the nuts, whatever is in there, it can't get its hand out anymore while it's holding onto the bait inside. Same thing's going on with us and money quite often. That's what's happening with this guy in this passage. He's got his hand caught in the jar, and he's holding onto the bait. And he walks away sad. Jesus recognizes that this guy can't follow him and keep his possessions. You know, saying yes to Jesus always means saying no to everything else, which means you got to let go of the bait there. You know, that's true for all of us. Now, absolutely, it is true. I know some of you are thinking, but rich people follow Jesus. Like Zacchaeus, he gives away a lot of his wealth. He doesn't give it all away. You know, there are other rich people who follow Jesus in Scripture. You're right. Absolutely. But Jesus tells this guy to leave it all behind. And we've got to deal with that. Some people, he says, the problem is more drastic. And who's to say that I am not that guy in Scripture? I mean, let's find out. Let's have a test. If Jesus came up to me and said, Ben, you are going to spend the rest of your life living off the charity of other people, and you're going to be visiting food banks and soup kitchens, you're going to take public transit for the rest of your life, you're going to be dependent on other people, but don't worry, it'll be great because we will be closer than ever, would I sign up? I think if Jesus said that to you, it'd be pretty hard. Because when I asked myself that question this week, I didn't like the answer. Now, I'm not saying that this passage is telling us that all of us are going to have to take a vow of poverty, but I am using that exercise to show us exactly the condition of what's going on inside. Because I got my hand in that jar. And we love money so much, we write songs about it. Sitting in the sun, counting my money. I Googled songs about money. It came up with so many. I'm sure if we polled you guys right now, you could tell me all of your favorite songs about money. You know, when Dan was doing sound back there, he had interesting songs about money. What was it? ZZ Top or Pink Floyd or something. Anyway, there are lots and lots of songs about money. Because it's something we love, right? Our culture loves this. Sitting in the sun, counting my money, happy as I can be, sweeter than the honey, is count my money. Those greenbacks on the trees. This is a huge problem for our culture. And if I am this man, if I'm that monkey with its hand in the jar, you know, how am I going to avoid this man's fate? That's the question, isn't it? And it's a basic assumption that he's already giving. That's just a basic assumption within Judaism. And he's already taking care of his neighbor with his money. He said he's loved his neighbor as himself. I think what we probably need to take from this is that we need to go beyond simply giving to practicing generosity. And that's something a little different. So how much should we give and how often? This is what C.S. Lewis had to say about it. You'll see it on the screen. I do not believe that one can settle how much we ought to give. I'm afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. In other words, if our expenditure on comforts and luxuries, amusements, etc., is up to the standard common among those with the same income as our own, we're probably giving away too little. If our charities do not at all pinch and hamper us, I should say they are too small. There ought to be some things we should like to do and cannot do because our charitable expenditures exclude them. We need to be reminded about the danger of money. We need to make sure that our assets don't become liabilities like this man's did. And that goes for our spiritual life, the resume that we bring to God. We need to practice confession and humility, but it goes for our material life as well. Our physical assets become liabilities and we get caught with our hand in the jar. And I don't want to see that happen to any of us. And I certainly don't want to see it happen to me. Which means we need to practice generosity, not just giving. So this man walks away saddened because he had lots of money. Passage goes on, verse 23, then Jesus said to his disciples, truly I tell you, it would be hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God. When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astounded and said, then who can be saved? But Jesus looked at them and said, for mortals it is impossible, but for God all things are possible. I am sure that you have heard, as I have heard many times, that the eye of a needle was the gate in Jerusalem, and a camel that couldn't make it through the gate if it was loaded, and so the camel had to be unloaded and maybe kneel and crawl through this tiny little gate and then be reloaded on the other side. How many of you have heard that? Yes, a number of you. It's not true. Like, there's no evidence that there was ever a gate in Jerusalem in Jesus' time called the Eye of the Needle, right? And I've read that in multiple commentaries this week that are just reaffirming that that is sort of, that was a story that got made up to soften this text. I mean, the idea is that, well, it's not impossible for rich people to enter the kingdom of heaven. They just have to divest themselves a little bit, and it's just going to be a little harder. No, Jesus uses this ridiculous hyperbole about a camel going through a real eye of a needle because it's impossible. That's the point of the hyperbole. So don't neuter the text. I mean, there's some power here that Jesus is bringing out because he's using hyperbole. Right? That's the whole point of the text. So Jesus is saying as strongly as he can that we need to be really, really careful about money. Let's not get trapped with our hand in the jar. Verse 27, then Peter said in reply, but look, we've left everything and we followed you. What then? What are we going to have? And Jesus said, truly I tell you, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man is seated on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or fields for my sake, for my name's sake, will receive 100-fold and will inherit eternal life. Peter asks a really interesting question, doesn't he? What's in it for me? Like, we've already made some sacrifices for you. Now, he doesn't say that they have sold everything and given it all away. He says, we left it at home. Yeah, we're currently following you. We've still got our stuff at home, but we've left a lot. We've made sacrifices, right? We're here with you, Jesus. We're following you. We're not like this rich guy. No, what's in it for us? What's in it for me? And interestingly, Jesus doesn't mind that this is a selfish question. And he says, well, actually, there is something in it for you. There's going to be reward. We never talk about that, do we? We never think about that. I personally don't. But there is going to be reward in following Jesus. And it probably won't be just spiritual. And it probably won't be just later on. Jesus does actually promise that there is going to be something rewarding in following him. But he does say, in the renewal of all things. He's talking about a time when heaven comes to earth and there's judgment, and then he says there's going to be rewards after the judgment. We tend to think of heaven, at least I do, as sort of Christian communism, where everything's going to be perfectly equal. That's just not the biblical picture at all. Everything is going to be decidedly very, quite, extremely unequal. Because that's the picture Jesus is portraying here. There are going to be rewards. And it's going to be based on a few things. And it's going to be based on that evaluation that takes place. It's a really interesting thought. Okay, I've talked for long enough. Would anyone like to interact a little bit? Anything that you'd like to raise, something I didn't talk about, something I need to clarify? Well, what about? So Ainsley's raising the point that she's in the position of being a poor student and relying on the generosity of her parents to help her through school, and has few means, some, but not many. So what about this passage? Well, that's a wonderful question. I lived in that world for like way longer than I just finished paying off that world. So I've been there quite a bit, and I'm sure many of us have as well. Like, this is part of how we started out. I think there are still small ways, like personally, there were still small ways where we practiced generosity even with what we had. So what we started to do was scale back our lifestyle as much as we could so that we still had something to give to other people. Now, ultimately, we are still incurring student debts, but that, you know, we had a plan for how to pay that off. But there are still ways that we can look at our own lifestyle and go, I should still have something to give to someone else in need. I mean, the Apostle Paul makes that point in one of his letters where he tells people that are sitting around waiting for Jesus to come back that you need to get a job, not just so that you can take care of yourself, but also so that you can help out other people. And, you know, that's probably good advice even for a student as well. And I know that you offer your means in a variety of ways. So I think that's something that we can all look at. How can I scale back what I currently have so that I have more to give? Great question. That's probably only the start of it, and be a great coffee conversation. Yeah, James.
Okay, so how you said, like a camel, it's easier for him to go through the eye of a needle, which is impossible. Mm-hmm.
So James is asking, Jesus has used this vivid imagery of the camel going through the eye of a needle, and he's saying, well, that's impossible. So he's on the same road as the disciples. He's tracking along with the disciples' thinking because they have the same reaction. They go, it's impossible. So James is asking, so is it impossible for rich people to enter heaven? Is that a good summary? Yeah. That's a great summary, and that's a great question. That's the same reaction that the disciples have, and Jesus assures them that even if that's impossible, God can do the impossible. So that's how Jesus ends that first section, where he says, yeah, it's going to be really hard. In fact, it's impossible, but God's going to take care of it. So, and at the same time, that doesn't change the fact that you still got to deal with your issue of you got your hand caught in the jar there. Because this guy walks away from Jesus, doesn't he? So he's walking away from God himself. So how is God going to make that possible if he walks away from him? So, interesting. Good question. Way to go. Anyone else want to raise anything? Mm-hmm. So for those of you that couldn't hear it, Kevin is raising the point that the demand is essentially, or the advice is, that we not just give out of our abundance, but that we give till it hurts a little bit. And he quotes C.S. Lewis and the woman who gives her last two coins and says, you know, giving ought to hurt a little bit. It should pinch and hamper us. It should be sacrificial. And yep, agreed. Right, that's Lewis's point, that if what we do with our money is the exact same as the people who don't follow Jesus, there's a really serious problem going on here. So it should actually change our lifestyle, and our lifestyle should reflect our hearts and our attitudes towards money. And I mean, Jesus is really emphasizing that money itself is dangerous. It's not just something that we steward, but it's something that we have to actually be aware of. It's a problem. Great. Yeah, you're right. Sacrificial giving, absolutely. Yeah, Dwight. Dwight's saying that the passage leaves us hanging and that this guy goes away sad. Now he wonders whether that could be another biblical character who seemed to be in the same position, Barnabas. The passage seems to invite us to sort of reflect on, would we be sad if we were in that position? And he also makes the point that it doesn't say that he didn't go and obey. Yeah, it doesn't say that he didn't go away and obey, but Jesus' command was to do two things. It was to sell everything, but then it was to follow him. And he leaves Jesus, so that seems to imply that therefore he didn't do the first one either. But we can hope. Yeah. And you're right, absolutely, that it does invite us to reflect. We should always be putting ourselves into the story. put ourselves into the story to find out how it is that Jesus responds to me, you know, and how much do I identify with these particular characters? I really identify with this guy. Yeah, great. And you're right, he does have a bad rap. And, you know, that ought to be a warning for us in some ways. Okay, one more. Lionel's making the point that I read this passage, he says, really differently in my 20s than I do in my 60s. And yeah, same here. Like, when I studied it in high school and in Bible college and seminary, yeah, I can look down my nose at all of those other rich people because I've got student debts and I'm going to do this to serve the Lord. And, you know, I'm never going to make a lot of money. And now I'm in my 30s. And I'm making money, thank you. And I married a rich teacher, which doesn't hurt. And I read this passage really differently. And I wriggled on my hook this week in a way that I certainly didn't before. And you're absolutely right that we do need to balance this passage with Zacchaeus and with Nicodemus and with the women who follow Jesus and support Jesus out of the means that they have because they come from wealthy families. Absolutely. Yes, I hear all that, and I've still got to deal with this guy. Yep. Tension, difficulty, but I can't just dismiss it. I'm not saying you are. But I got to deal with this passage, and I got to deal with my own heart and the fact that I see myself here way more than I want to. Let's check in after the service so that I don't keep everyone else, because we went way longer than normal. Great interaction, great questions. C.S. Lewis has another really good quote. He says, "There are far better things ahead than anything we leave behind." Now, that's really interesting. The things that we sacrifice for God, we're going to get something better back. The things that bring us joy in this life, whether it's a sunset, whether it's music, whether it's time with your family, the things that bring you joy, there is more joy than that ahead of us. There is. In whatever way that is personal for you, whatever it is that brings you glimpses of joy, it's coming. It's coming. But it has something to do, getting there has something to do with becoming a child, becoming childlike in how we approach Jesus. It's going to have a lot to do with our humility, and it's going to have a lot to do with what we sacrifice here in order to get there. And it's going to have everything to do with following Jesus. So let's make sure we don't get our hands caught in those traps.